The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Tuesday, February 28th, 2012. And for the record, we do have quorum at this time. The first bill was scheduled to be Senator Hand's 775 bill. That will be delayed until further notice. And we will move on to Senator Newman, Senate File 1515, Landlord and Tenant Fees and Eviction Notices. If anyone is in the audience to participate in the discussion regarding Senator Hand's dental licensing provisions, that will not occur today. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1272 is a file which clarifies the intention with respect to late fees that landlords can charge when tenants are late with their monthly rent payments. Last year, the legislature enacted a number of changes to the state's landlord-tenant laws, and among those changes were products of negotiations between the public housing agencies, the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, which represents private landlords, and legal services, which looks to protect the interests of tenants. One of the provisions that was passed last year establishes a limit on late fees that landlords can charge. That limit was set at not to exceed 8% of the tenant's monthly rent. There was also a provision made for public agencies to rely upon federal statute regulations or handbooks to set late fees for tenants who are late in paying their rent. Since the 2010 session, there has been some question about whether the language clearly separates the public agency's abilities to set their limits in accordance with federal statutes, rules, or handbooks from the 8% cap. This was clearly the intention last year of all of the parties to the negotiations. This bill simply makes it clear the distinction between the 8% cap and the ability of public agencies to rely upon the guidance they have received from the public programs that support the public housing facilities. Language in the second section of the bill simply changes the dates relating to eviction from properties subject to foreclosure and conforms to federal timetables. Mr. Chairman, I have with me Mr. Kevin Wally representing NARU, who can answer any questions that committee members may have with respect to the specific contents of the bill.
Are there any questions for the author? Senator Newman, do you have any amendments for your bill?
I do not.
Mr. Wally, did you want to make any comment at this time?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, only that I think the version of the bill that's before the committee is actually the House File 1515, which has made its way to the committee.
All right. Thank you. All right, is there further discussion? Hearing none, Senator Newman renews his motion of that House File number 1515 be recommended to pass, and it may be moved directly to the floor.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Thank
Mr.
you,
Chairman.
Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Harrington. Welcome to the committee, Senator Harrington.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You have Senate File 2028.
That is correct.
Regarding fugitive apprehension. Please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, the Fugitive Apprehension Unit is a subset of the Minnesota Department of Correction. It was created in 2000 by Minnesota Statute 241.025. That statute enabled the Department of Corrections to create a law enforcement agency within the Department of Corrections that would then be able to enforce laws, rules, and its primary function is to recapture escapees from correctional facilities. When the original legislation was put forth, there was a great deal of concern by law enforcement about expansion of jurisdiction to new agencies. And because of that, there was a one-sentence line put into the original legislation which limited the Fugitive Apprehension Unit's members from applying for search warrants in furtherance of their investigations. Over the past 12 years, law enforcement has come to rely heavily on the Fugitive Apprehension Unit, both in working on recapturing escapees, folks that had absconded, and working on investigations that go from inside correctional facilities to the community. And over that time frame, law enforcement has really learned that that one line has become a cumbersome nuisance more than anything else. What happens now is when the Fugitive Apprehension Unit is in search of an individual and needs to get a search warrant, they have to go to the local jurisdiction, find an officer or preferably or a sergeant who can apply for the warrant, inform them of all of the particulars of the case, get them up to speed so they can then fill out an affidavit for the warrant, have accompany them oftentimes to get the warrant, at which point now the Fugitive Apprehension Unit can use the warrant's legal authority to do what they need to do, but then the law enforcement agency now has the responsibility for filing all the appropriate papers after the warrant has been served. It's an unnecessary encumbrance that most law enforcement agencies have found is totally unnecessary. So this bill eliminates that one line from the enabling statutory language, effectively eliminating the line that says the Fugitive Apprehension Unit are not authorized to apply for a search warrant and thereby grants them the power to apply for search warrants on their own cases. I have one testifier with me today. It is Carrie Gerlicher, who is effectively the chief of police for the Fugitive Apprehension Unit. Carrie is an old associate from the Midwest Gang Investigative Association and has previous employment as a detective with the Minneapolis Police.
Ms. Gerlicher, do we call you chief? What's your title?
Mr. Chair, the title is director.
Director.
You can call me whatever you want.
Right now, I'm going to call you director. Thank you for coming, and please proceed. Would you identify yourself for the record?
I will, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Carrie Gerlicher. I am the Director, Chief Law Enforcement Officer for the Minnesota Department of Corrections Office of Special Investigations. The legislature created, as Senator Harrington said, the Minnesota Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit in 2000. At the time, again, as Senator Harrington stated, there were some concerns from other law enforcement community members that the fugitive unit would become more involved in criminal cases in their jurisdictions other than just fugitive apprehension. And so in order to put minds at ease, we agreed with the adding of the sentence that the fugitive unit would not execute search warrants. But now with new technology, primarily with computers and cell phones, our need has greatly increased to author and execute search warrants. We arrest over 400 convicted felons every year. Oftentimes, these apprehensions are based on the information that we get out of search warrants. Normally, it is running what we call a ping on a cell phone. One of our fugitives may be in custody of a cell phone and using that cell phone, and our ability through phone companies to actually track that phone oftentimes helps us locate them, not only in this state but out of state. In fact, we've used that technology in Mexico as well. So what happens today is that I have to go to another outside law enforcement agency to write that search warrant for me. So I may be taking a detective from your community off a case that they're working to stop for an hour, listen to our case, understand our probable cause, draw the search warrant, go up to a judge, have it signed, and then assist us in executing that search warrant, when, quite frankly, the case wasn't theirs to begin with, and it really kind of becomes a nuisance for them. So we're requesting that our officers have the ability to write and execute those search warrants on their own.
Is there any questions for the director? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Harrington, any contact from local law enforcement agencies as to how they feel about this bill?
Senator Newman, Mr. Chairman, my contacts with Minnesota chiefs and Minnesota sheriffs, and they are not opposed to this bill.
Any further discussion? Hearing none. Senator. Senator Harrington, this bill will be laid over for inclusion in an omnibus Department of Corrections bill. So at this moment, we're going to leave it on the table.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, committee. I appreciate it.
I'm going to hand the gavel over to Senator Newman while I present Senate File 2028. Nope, not 2028. Yes. Oh, yes. All right.
Members, just to give you a little heads up as to the game plan here, Senate File 2084, Senator Limmer's bill is the omnibus DOC vehicle bill. We're going to have Senator Limmer present this bill, and then next up would be Senator Latz. I'm just trying to give Senator Latz a little leeway. He has Senate File 1759 that would be heard and then held over for possible inclusion in the same manner that Senator Harrington's bill 2028 was heard. So with that brief explanation, Senator Limmer, to your bill, Senate File 2084.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. 2084, Senate File number 2084, is a bill that basically recodifies in a manner notification of victims upon the release of offenders. In this case, we're allowing electronic means to make that. Electronic means is not recognized in state law in this particular way. It's really quite a simple bill, and we have representatives from the Department of Corrections to explain the process and how electronic methods would be incorporated into that same notification.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. If you would please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. My name is Lydia Newlin, LYDIANEWLIN, and I am the Victim Services and Restorative Justice Coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. As Senator Limmer noted, this law really is just bringing up the current statute and what we do with the current legislation to include electronic processes and options for victims who want to or request information involving offenders who are incarcerated with the Department of Corrections, and it also involves offenders who then move or may move on to the Department of Human Services under commitment status. Thanks for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I wanted to be able to provide you a little bit of an overview of what our electronic system does and how we got here today. Oftentimes in conversations that involve offenders, especially from corrections, we oftentimes I don't always remember that there are victims out there that are affected by everything that we do with our offenders. And our administration has been absolutely fantastic about making sure that we keep the victims involved in decisions that are made so that when we're doing things with offenders, we aren't inadvertently re-injuring victims. The state of Minnesota has several different mechanisms for notification of victims. It can be very confusing for victims because prior to disposition, victims are automatically notified when it comes to what's happening with the offenders. Once the offender is sentenced in a court, most of the information that victims receive only comes to them if they ask for it. And so up until we implemented our automatic or our electronic victim notification system, it was very frustrating and confusing for victims because they had to ask over and over again different departments, different agencies to get information about what was happening with the person who harmed them. That's one of the big things that the electronic system now does, is that victims can request to access information and be notified about many different processes all in one registration process with Minnesota Choice. I'll just take a few minutes here and go over what our process does and what the electronic system does, and then I'd be happy to take questions. Before we implemented our automatic or our electronic victim notification system, as I noted, victims had to actually send us a letter or send the Commissioner of Corrections a letter and ask to be notified. That letter then followed the offender through the process in paper form. And then when the offender's status changed or they were released, we would go to that paper file and try to determine if, in fact, the victim had requested notification. We wanted to be able to change that so that victims could request notification electronically and also be provided that information electronically. So the Department of Corrections partnered with the Department of Public Safety. We applied for a federal grant, which we were able to get. And in 2009, we were awarded that grant and we began to develop Minnesota Choice. In December of 2010, we actually went live with that program. The goals of Minnesota Choice were to centralize that process, again, so that victims only have to ask one time and in one place to get information, also to reduce our human error, and also to offer options for notification in other ways outside of just U.S. mail. That would involve and does involve now email and message center, meaning that victims can choose when they go in and get the information about the offenders. We would have victims that would call us and say that it was real traumatizing for them to come home after work, be making dinner, and be flipping through their mail and see a letter from us giving them information about the person who harmed them. So what Minnesota Choice does is an electronic process where victims can choose how they get that information and when they get that information. We also wanted to be able to verify that the victims that we were trying to contact were actually where they told us they initially were. When we began to incorporate our old system with our new system, what we learned is that about 35% of our requests from our victims, we had inaccurate information. They had not kept us posted on what their address changes were. So this was a way to be able to contact victims once a year and make sure that the information that we have for them and the information that they want to get from us is actually the same as it was a year ago. Another key or another important thing that we wanted to do when we created and developed Minnesota Choice is to do a better job connecting our supervising agents in the field with the victims that we work with. That supervising agent in the field is a critical relationship for that victim so that the victim can kind of keep track of what's happening with the offender and be able to continue to get information once that offender moves into the community to be under supervision. And so our electronic system connects victims and the supervising agents at the exact same time prior to an offender's release into the community. We wanted to also be able to let our victims know that we have processes out there that we call restorative justice processes. Many people believe that when an offender is sentenced to prison or jail or probation, that that in itself is healing for a victim. And what we know is that that isn't always true. And in fact, in many cases, our victims are coming to us at corrections and wanting more information. Something as simple as, do you know if this offender has ever taken responsibility or apologized for what they have done? Or even on a more significant level, some of our victims want to actually meet and sit across the table from the person who injured them or maybe took the life of a loved one. So we have a process in place called victim-offender dialogue, where if a victim requests that contact and that dialogue, we assign facilitators and we have a very methodical way of making sure that that need is met for that victim in a safe manner. And we wanted to be able to let victims know that they could request that as well as participate in those processes. We accomplished those goals with implementing our Minnesota Choice system. We centralized the process. We reduced some of our costs. As I mentioned before, 25% of our victims are now requesting and being notified by electronic, so email or message center. Our agents are now provided victim information simultaneously with victims. Victims are able to participate in the reentry process. And one of the most astounding things for me is that we increased victim requests and participation in restorative justice practices by 300% in the first year that we went live with the system. Last year, we had 1,460 new victim registrants in the system, and we provided over 6,100 notifications to victims who wanted information about the offenders who harmed them. This last year, we applied for an enhancement grant, which we have also received, and we are beginning to work on what we call Minnesota Choice 2. We will be incorporating restitution into the choice system. We'll be tracking, communicating, and holding offenders accountable in a much more transparent way as we move towards Minnesota Choice 2. We have also enhanced our collaboration with prosecutors, victim witness, and the Department of Human Services, which this bill speaks to. We will be able to work with our partners over at Department of Human Services and provide them the information that we have for the victims that are involved with the offenders that they serve there. And so that will be a big loophole that will be fixed with this legislation as well. We will increase our safety planning options for victims with regard to no contact requests, and we'll be adding some other enhancements, which would include video tutorials for our victims that give them more information about resources that are available to them. And we'll also be able to incorporate Skype meetings with our victims, so we'll be able to meet face-to-face with them from our St. Paul office. Our goals for this next year are to increase electronic notification by another 40%, to increase our victim notification requests by 25%. We will be hopefully also increasing our restorative justice requests, reduce our reentry and no-contact complaints or concerns that we get from the community and from victims, as well as to incorporate some other options for victims, such as requesting HIV. Victims have a right to request HIV results or testing be done on the offenders who injured them if they're victims of sexual assault. And what we're going to be incorporating into our electronic process is an opportunity for victims to be able to let us know what medical provider they might like to get the results of that from, so that they're not contacted by the Department of Health's intimate partner notification program. When you're victimized sexually, you need to have a little different notification and little different support system available to you if that HIV result comes back positive. So with that, I thank you for letting us share a little bit with you what we've done with the electronic process. Again, this legislation will just clean up things and allow us to be able to provide victims information electronically if they want to, as well as to share their requests with our partners at the Department of Human Services and our prosecutors.
Thank you, Ms. Newland. Any of the members have any questions for Ms. Newland? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Newman, the slide near the end about the 50% reduction in reentry and no contact assistance calls, in other words, you had simply having them participate in this has cut the number of calls for requests from somebody. I assume that's a violation of a no contact order. You've had a 50% reduction in those calls from folks in this?
Mr. Chair and Senator Marty.
I'm just reading that.
Thank you. That's one of our goals. It's one of our upcoming goals. One of the things that happens when an offender comes to prison is that a court-ordered DANCO or no contact order is no longer in effect once the offender comes to us. So victims are many times contacted by offenders who are incarcerated and then contact our office asking what can be done about that. What choice will allow is for victims to request that no contact as soon as the offender comes to us. We are then able to hold that offender accountable for violating a direct order. And our hope is to reduce those calls from victims up front so that they don't have to be victimized all over again by that offender with that first call.
So Mr. Chairman, in effect, that's
Senator
the
Martin.
Goal of what you're hoping to get. It's not that that's...
It's the goal that, Mr. Chair and Senator Marty, yes, the Minnesota Choice 2 is what we are currently adding. Yes.
Any other questions? Senator Limmer, do you have any other testifiers or any more testimony as to this aspect of your bill?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify to Senate File 2084? Seeing none, at this
point,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Newling. This may be in here, and I'm just not reading it fast enough, but will it be coordinating with any, is there any need to be coordinating with any outside or any out-of-state agencies or anything, or is this strictly within Minnesota?
There's no one.
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, at this point, we are not coordinating with other states because we are the first state to have Minnesota Choice, obviously because we're Minnesota. Yeah. But we're the first state to have choice. The exciting thing is that many other states are following in our footsteps and have applied for the grant as well. And there are three other states that will be going live this next year with their own choice system. And, yes, it is a goal to coordinate with other states so that the information can cross state lines.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, at this point, Senator Harrington, I'm going to ask that you orally move your file 2028 as amendment or as an amendment to Senate File 2084, which is we're going to put it on the omnibus bill.
So moved.
Any members have any questions regarding Senator Harrington's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. At this point, I would ask that Senator Latz testify as to Senate File 1759. Just remind us very briefly as to what your bill is about. We've already had public testimony on this, I believe, but just to remind and help the members.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members, there are a couple of reports that are required by the by statute for the agency to provide, and the one that I'm proposing to eliminate is basically redundant, provides information that is later incorporated into another report, and so this will reduce the staff time necessary to produce that redundant report.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might add, it actually saves money, too.
Saves money.
Save money.
$7,800. Anyone opposed to saving money?
And as I understand it, Senator Latz, it is your wish to move Senate File 1759 as amended to Senate File 2084.
So moved.
Any discussion insofar as Senator Latz's motion? Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much money are we saving?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, the fiscal note shows a savings of $8,000 in staff time. That is currently absorbed in the agency, and it's anticipated that it would free up the staff rather than realizing itself in actual dollars to be spent. Free up the staff to focus on higher priority items.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note actually exaggerated that because the report said it only cost $7,812 last year.
Any further discussion to Senator Latz's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer, it's my understanding that you have an amendment that you wish to offer to Senate File 2084. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That would be the A2 amendment that may be in your packets. This is in conjunction
one more
with
Senator Limerick. I don't. The amendment has not yet been passed out. It's in the process of.
All right.
So, as it's being passed out, please go ahead.
Just so everyone knows how to follow along with my presentation, the A2 amendment is additional language of direction to the Department of Corrections regarding the amendment I'm soon to introduce is Senate File 1747. You may remember that was regarding the challenge incarceration program eligibility and the modifications that we created then. What I'm wanting to do in that, and you may remember we had quite a discussion. We were talking about the merits of the challenge incarceration program. It was a good program. We all agreed that it was. But there has been times over history that it sometimes just simply loses population because of some restrictions that the legislature has placed on it. So I wanted to have this discussion to be sensitive to the discussion we had about the challenge incarceration program. We have a couple options to consider. We can go back to the way the law was previously written before 2009, which gives the commissioner full discretion over the eligibility of who participates with very, very few exceptions. Or we could go with the Department of Corrections bill with the knowledge that they may be coming back in the near future and we do have this discussion all over again. And that would probably include either more people to exclude from the program. This year, we'd be adding drive-by shootings, criminal vehicular homicide, and other elements of criminal law. Or we could do something totally in between. One suggestion was to go with the Department of Correction bill as we left it last time. That's the bill that I would want to amend. Or what we could do is offer something in between previous law and the concept of no commissioner discretion at all. The A2 amendment before you will leave this statute 244.17 subdivision 3 as is. People convicted of serious crime like murder, criminal sexual conduct, assault, kidnapping, and robbery will continue to be ineligible for the challenge program. And instead, we will offer the commissioner discretion over all other offenders and their particular situations, including those of drive-by shootings, criminal vehicular homicide or operation, and discharge of a firearm. The reason for that is we will give the commissioner's discretion so that we can keep this valuable program alive, going, viable with membership in the program. I've created a statement, and on A2 lines 1, 9 through 12, you have a statement that it is absolutely our intention that the commissioner not allow beds to go empty in a valuable program such as this, and that it would be our legislative intent that the commissioner, we hope, would keep the program full. And my purpose in doing this is I want to trust the commissioner for doing the job that he's hired to do. We, over many years, I've noticed that we like to get in and we like to tweak and mess around with programs and agencies, and I've always been one that gets very uncomfortable doing that. The person that's hired to run the program, the commissioners in our agencies, are the ones that are the best suited in order to determine the manageability of their institution. And in this particular case, especially with this particular commissioner, I have full trust in his ability to make those proper decisions. I do not want to continually revisit this issue with whatever vagary of headline seems to indicate to us that we have to take some revenge motive or some other aspect of being politically correct and tweak someone else's policies in their administration. I don't think that gives a continuity to the programs, and in most cases, many of us that just see the headlines from time and again aren't qualified to make the proper decision anyway. So I hope you would follow along with the A2 amendment, and I'll stand for any questions.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wimmer, I'm really pleased you're choosing this approach because it was pretty clear when the department came in with the bill last week or whenever that because they had to accept anyone who fit in these categories, they saw somewhere, they may sometime want to rule somebody out. And I think you're right, by making it where they have the discretion again instead of the shall select, and keep the restrictions we had in the past,
I think it was a little overkill a few years ago when the legislature said, we're going to tell you who you can't put in and everyone else you have to put in it. I think this, you're right, we would have been here every, at least once a year with new bills on it, and I think this is a very fair approach to it, so thank you.
Any other questions as to the A2 amendment? Senator Letts.
Mr. Chair, just a drafting question. I'm trying to match this up with the committee engrossment that it was in our folders. I'm trying to understand. I don't see anything that specifically, unless I'm missing it, that deletes the changes that are that the provisions that are in the original bill. And I'm not even sure the line numbers match up properly because the I didn't get an explanation. Maybe I'm missing it completely.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Letts, the amendment is actually drafted to the vehicle bill, Senate File 2084. So we just add these new provisions there.
Gotcha. That clears it up. Thank you.
Any further questions as to the A2 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, one other point.
Senator Lemon.
I think when we consider correction law, the philosophy, if there is one that we really adhere to, is that we, of course, try to make the punishment fit the crime. But we kind of stop there over time. We judge the progress of an individual in prison as if the only thing we focus on is the crime. 10 years could go by in incarceration. 10 years, hopefully, of rehabilitation of some sort could occur. And to just blanketly say anyone who commits a crime is excluded from a different type of incarceration would really be wrong on our part to budge our way into that process. And the challenge incarceration program is one that I know that some inmates really want to get into. And it can be a tool to motivate people to have proper behavior within the institution that they're in. And it could be used as almost a reward process as well. And so it's good for the management. It's a tool that can be used, and I think we should give the commissioner full discretion on it. Mr. Chairman, what is the motion that I need to make now? Do I move the A2 amendment?
The correct motion would be to move the A2 amendment to add it to Senate File 2084.
All right. So moved, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted, and I am reminded that we are now going to Senate File 2084, and as I understand it, Senator Limmer, your motion will be to move the bill as amended to the Finance Committee, and that we will, as we pass it, give Council the authority to put the bill in the correct shape so that it, as it moves forward.
Mr. Chair, did we move the amendment in the form of Senate File 1747? Did we move that into the bill yet?
Yes.
Yeah.
Moved in.
Senator Limmer, we moved the A2 amendment. We did not move Senate File 1747.
Okay.
So it's the A2 amendment that is, in effect, replaced.
That replaces it.
47.
I have no further presentation, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer has moved Senate File 2084 as amended to go to the Finance Committee, and that Council will have the authority to put the bill in the proper form. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Limmer's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion is adopted. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.